My castaway this week is the jazz musician and veteran radio presenter Humphrey Littleton. He formed his first band in 1948 and, described by Louis Armstrong as Britain's top trumpeter, has been touring ever since. His chosen profession betrays an upper-crust lineage. His father was a famous housemaster at Eton, and childhood holidays were often spent at the stately homes of titled relatives. His radio career began with shows about jazz, but it's in his role as Chairman Humph on Radio 4's I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue that he's gained cult status as the deadpan purveyor of blue-chip filth to Middle England. Humphrey Littleton, you've been a quizmaster then on that show since 1972, but your real love, your first love, jazz.
Yes, indeed, yes. Sometimes people ask me, what's the most important thing? And I say, well, if ever I slump forward, it's not going to be on a computer keyboard. It'll be trumpet in hand.
What is it about the jazz that so captivates you?
Well, I was fascinated by music from a very, very early age. The trumpet came quite late. I had a love affair with the harmonica for a long time.
And drums as well? You played
and drums? And drums, yes. I fiddled about with that for a while, and my mother thought, as mothers do, that I was showing enormous promise. So she answered an advert in the local paper for a drum teacher. And a man called Mr. Glass came down, and I can remember the moment when he came into the room, and my mother said, of course, Humphrey's worked a lot on the drums himself, and he's learned quite a lot. To which Mr. Glass said, well, we'll soon unlearn him all that.
You, of course, moved on to the trumpet. What was it about the trumpet that interested you from the beginning? Did something spark your imagination?
I was rather taken by the sight of Louis Armstrong playing the trumpet, because there he was, had him in heraldic posture with the trumpet pointing at the ceiling.
That's with the head thrown back.
Head thrown back and everything. And it was only when I started to learn the trumpet that I discovered that it's absolutely fatal if you do that, because, if you'll pardon the expression, all the spit runs back into the mouthpiece and you get a rather bubbling performance in the wrong sense of the word.
You are still performing at the age of 85. Has your appetite to perform, your appetite to tour, diminished at all?
Not in the slightest. I'm rather worried about it. No, it hasn't. I still wake up in the morning with ideas. Sometimes they keep me awake at the crack of dawn. Ideas for things to do with the band. I've just done a recording session. We did 19 tracks in 4 days, and every morning I've been waking up with tunes in my head. And as long as that goes on, I want to get out there with the band and play them.
We're going to talk about that much later. Let's hear your first Desert Island disc.
Well, I go to that time when I was learning the drum with Mr. Glass, and he first of all took me up to the Victoria Barracks up in Windsor, waiting for the band to come out of the barracks and lead the guard, the new guard, up to Windsor Castle, where they do the changing of the guard. And I can remember still the thrill of hearing the command, by the left, quick march, and then you'd have the 5-beat roll on the drums. So I'd like to have a record by one of my heroes, Kenneth Alford, the British march king. His most famous march has been very badly treated. Rude words have been put to it, and so on. But it's always a favourite of mine, and has in one section of it a counter melody which is absolutely beautiful.
Thank you.
the band of the Royal Marines and Colonel Bogey. So, Humphrey, you didn't just go to Eton, you were born at Eton in the spring of 1921.
I was, yes, May the 23rd, 1921.
And that was because your dad was a schoolmaster?
My dad was a schoolmaster. He was an assistant master then, which was all the masters who weren't housemasters were called assistant masters. And I was born there.
And it was a sort of classic upper crust household of the 1920s. I mean, the children were separate in the house, and there were nursemaids, and mummy was somewhere downstairs.
That's right, yes. I was brought up by a nanny Vigors, a very, very strict lady, but a very nice lady.
She was pretty vigorous with the slipper, I understand, at Nanny Vigors.
It was the first time I ever discovered that part of life was to bend over and be hit on the backside by some implement of some kind.
Difficult now for people of the generation who are having children to understand that. I mean, if you woke in the middle of the night in tears, or you had a bad cold, or was it mummy you went to, or was it Nanny Vigors you went to?
Oh, Nanny Vigors. And said there was a spare bed in her bedroom, and you could sleep in there for the rest of the night. I think it was quite a common thing with nannies. You spent so much of your life with them that you were absolutely heartbroken when they left.
Did you have a close relationship with your mother, though? I mean, were things good between you and Mum, or did you not really see her very often?
Oh, no, they were always good. My mother was... She was an amazing person. She was very humorous. But my mother was... she was a very strong woman. But she went from an upbringing in Babram Hall, with butlers and servants and all this kind of business. She went in 1916 to the front. So that within 3 weeks of leaving that sort of very sheltered upbringing, she was behind the lines outside Rouen.
And so tending the injured soldiers on the front line, did that leave its mark on her? Did she talk about that to you?
She did. We went to see the scenes of battle, you know, in France in sometime in our teens. And I remember my mother, when confronted with the graves, you know, which were just one whole field. And she broke down then.
You had four sisters. You were the only boy. So did you ever feel overwhelmed by all that femininity?
When I was about eight, I suppose, my parents bought me a bicycle for Christmas. And I hopped on it and pedalled fast, because all my sisters were at boarding school as well, and they all had very hearty friends used to come. And I was an age when one sort of bolted from hearty females. I still do, actually.
You're quite a shy boy.
I was very shy, yes, terribly. I set fire to a vicar once, out of shyness.
Now you're going to have to explain yourself.
Well, I was wandering about the house at the age of, I don't know, what, 5, 6 or something. One of the parents wandered in, and he was a vicar. And I was suddenly confronted in the hallway of the house by this total stranger. And didn't know what to do at all. So in desperation, I lowered my head and butted him in the midriff. And he burst into flames, which might have been some evidence that I had some kind of satanic influence in my early days. But the truth was that he had a packet of Swan Vestas non-safety matches in his waistcoat, and I'd ignited the whole lot with one punch. But that's what Chinese does for you.
That was your second record.
Second record goes to a love that I shared with my father of the monologues that were recorded in the mid-30s by Arthur Marshall. And my father and I used to love this. It was at one of the meeting points, you know, there was, and we both played golf, and so that we had quite a lot of time together. A lot of it was heaving with laughter at Arthur Marshall's description, for example, in the role of a schoolmistress. Taking the children on a nature walk.
Left, right, left, right, left, right. Keep in step with the head of the crocodile. Sylvia, dear, don't slough about so. Hips firm and torso trim, if you please. That's the ticket. We'll soon be there. Oh, eyes left, girls, eyes left. Look, there's a rarely splendid specimen of a Jersey cow. What a fine, sturdy old creature she is, to be sure. Now, what's she up to, I wonder? Oh, eyes right, girls, eyes right, Millie, eyes right, dear, this instant. Left, right, Gloria. Put that marshmallow back into your satchel and swing your arm properly, left, right. Ah, here we are at the meadow. Crocodile, halt. Crocodile, left, turn. Crocodile, sit down on the ground, but sit gingerly. Look out, sir. Just in time. Well, girls, Here we are, right in the thick of nature's generous pageant. Spring, heavenly miracle, a wondrous cycle. Brenda Manners. Spring, sprouting shoots and shooting sprouts. Spring, season of joy, and don't pick your face, Hilda. It's not a bit of good. Mother Nature's a wily one, dear. She'll have her way, do what you will. However, girls, we mustn't sit idling here. To work, and hunt about for some leafy treasures. Now, Chloe, dear, a real effort this time. Last week you were a mass of wart and nothing else. Ah, me, the merry month of May has flown, and King Cricket has lost a quarter of his reign. But all the same, girls, where is leafy June? Where is the magic that is summer? And where is Elspeth? Look, she's fallen plumb in the river. Life-saving team, form up. Inflate water wings. Keep your head, Elspeth, dear. Where's your sang-froid? What? It's full of water. Well, girls, bring her back alive, and I'll double the cocoa ration.
Chuckling away to that, Humphrey Littleton. Humphrey, that was Arthur Marshall and the Nature Walk. There was clearly then your father being a schoolmaster at Eton, clearly no question of where you would eventually go to school. But you went in the beginning to a boarding school aged eight in Surrey, and you've said that you felt marooned there, that there was much nocturnal sobbing under the blankets. You weren't happy at being sent away from home.
Well, I was 8 years old. My parents took me there, and, you know, I was full of apprehension. We were met by the headmaster, Mr. Crabtree. Sounds Dickensian, doesn't it? And there were a lot of bumptious boys already there who made friends already. Oh, dreadful. And then my parents, I think, thought the best thing to do was to hand me over to Mr. Crabtree and then get in the car and head off for the gate without saying goodbye or anything else. They thought that would be the best thing. And I can imagine my father saying to my mother, who was probably very upset, don't worry, he's probably made a lot of friends already. Well, in fact, I hadn't.
When you were at school then, there was a... Was he a teacher there, Geoffrey Fox, somebody who actually was instrumental in informing you as a little boy and guiding you?
Yes, Geoffrey Fox took over from Mr. Crabtree.
So was he was the headmaster?
He was the headmaster. It was a complete difference in style. And one of the things I did for him was doing cartoons on the stage. It was known then as Lightning Cartoons. It had a huge layout pad. I must have looked a right idiot. I stood up there, you know, doing these things and reading this patter about people like Mahatma Gandhi, Charlie Chaplin, and people like that.
So even in those early days, I mean, you clearly had the facility for doing a bit of a turn.
Oh, yes. I think I was a bit of a ham even at that stage.
You started playing trumpet then at Eton, was it? At the age of around about 15?
Yes.
How did it all begin?
Well, I'd had a band as a playing the harmonica. But then I heard Louis Armstrong and wanted to play the trumpet. So I got my mother to buy me a trumpet. And I walked into Charing Cross Road wearing, I may tell you, at the age of, 15, a top hat, a tailcoat, a silver waistcoat. I don't know what they thought of the apparition coming in. My mother trailed around behind me and said, wouldn't a clarinet be nicer?
What was it about, well, you say it was Louis Armstrong that captured you, but what was it about jazz in general that appealed to this 15-year-old boy?
On the surface of it, it was just fun. You know, the music was just good fun. But underneath it all, I think it was the fact that jazz music always contains a hint of pain. And it was that emotional side of it, I think, underneath that I like, because most of the music that I go for is highly emotional. And in the dead of night, I'd be known to sit there with not exactly in floods, but with a small trickle from time to time, listening to music.
We're going to hear your third record now. It's not a piece of jazz. Tell us about it.
This is part of that emotional thing. It's a recording of Beniamino Gigli in 1936, singing what I call Handel's Largo. And after leaving school, leaving Eton, I went to South Wales with a cousin of mine, to Port Talbot, and I suppose we were saved from utter boredom in the evenings by the fact we had a wind-up gramophone.
Oh,
Beniamino Gigli singing Ombra Mai Fu from Handel's Circe, giving you goosebumps there, Humphrey Lyttelton.
Indeed, yes. And it's got that cadence at the end. Da, 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 da. And I come over all goose pimples from head to foot with that particular sequence of things. I first came over, funny, when that was played in the nursery, when we used to listen to Who Killed Cock Robin? When he gets to all the birds in the air, da, 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 da. Fellow crying and a sobbing, crying and a sobbing. I was right there with him, loving like a maniac.
So Gigli there bringing back memories of Port Talbot. So in the evenings then, performing in what, the working men's clubs around Port Talbot?
We go down to the Velindra Working Men's Club. And
you said us, who were you, yeah, with
I
your cousin?
With my cousin. I had a double cousin, Anthony, who was like a brother to me. His mother was my mother's sister, and his father was my father's brother.
Oh.
So we always did everything together in those days.
After your time in Wales then, you were called up to the Grenadier Guards in 1941.
Yes.
How was that then, seeing frontline? You did see frontline service at one point.
Very briefly, yes. I went to North Africa in 1943 and trained to take part in the landing at Salerno. We went on stinking old troop ships, and we heard on the way over there that Italy had surrendered. So there was a general air of celebration.
Yes.
I had my trumpet with me. I took it wherever I went. But we didn't realize that the Germans had moved in immediately that the Italians surrendered. We landed on the beachhead, and the Germans cunningly allowed most of the ships to
disgorge the soldiers
until the beachhead was full, and then they started raining down the shells and things like that. And it was gruesome, you know, there's no doubt about it. On the other hand, I used to jazz up the last post. In those days, it was simply a bugle call saying, and the words that went with it were "lights out." Lights out. So people have come up to me at gigs now, and they say, "I remember you at Salerno," and you think, "Oh, we're going to have some sort of horrific memories." And they say, "You used to jazz up at the last post."
Your cousin Anthony, that you've described as similar to a brother to you, you were very close. He died in action during the Second World War.
He died in Anzio, yes.
How did you hear about that?
I heard about that when I was invalided back home when the news came through. My father came up. I remember him coming up into my bedroom, and he was very fond of Anthony. He could barely he just blurted out that Anthony had been killed. He gave me a sort of comforting, you know, pat on the shoulder,
yes,
on the shoulder, and went out, and he was very overcome by it.
What's your fourth record then, Humphrey Lyttelton?
It's a gospel number sung by one of the greatest of all gospel singers, Marion Williams, who has an absolute tornado of passion, and I love it.
It is well.
The power and passion of Marianne Williams and the stars of Faith and It Is Well. So, Humphrey Lyttelton, you're demobbed in 1946. You famously play outside Buckingham Palace on VE Day, and you decide then that you want to pursue art. You're going to pursue the cartooning talent that was exposed when you were at prep school in Sunningdale.
Well, it was a choice I had to make when I came out of the army. My father, I think, expected me to become a schoolmaster in his footsteps. So I went to my father, and in trepidation, because I thought he might be very disappointed. And then he asked me, what do you think you will do? So I said, well, I have two natural talents. One of them is for drawing, and the other is for music. So I went to Camberwell Art School to get a diploma in illustration. And at the same time joined a band called George Webb's Dixielanders.
Art and music, I mean, two things that tend to be chosen by people who like to buck convention. Were you an unconventional character in your mid-20s?
So I'm told. Well, I grew a beard, for one thing. I had a rather handsome auburn beard. Didn't have any money at that time. They used to tip you for taking part in the war. You had a tip. And a suit. They gave you a suit, a blue suit with a red pinstripe, dreadful things. And went along to the art school in the daytimes, and then went down to Barnhurst on Monday nights, I think it was, and played in the band.
And this idea that you were beyond convention, I mean, given that you'd come from such a conventional background, given that you were Eton educated, your father was an Eton housemaster, to be pursuing the line that you were was pretty unusual. I mean, the people who'd been with you at Eton would be going on to be clerics, or would going on to work in government, or you must have waved them all goodbye, and they must have wondered what you were up to.
I actually had quite a long depression through the process of sloughing off, as you might say, all the preparatory education that I had. Not necessarily what I'd learned, but all this sort of, how you behaved and what you were aiming for, and to get rid of all of that, it took a long time. I mean, I'd become what I call a romantic socialist during my time in Wales. I'd had my battle dress dyed blue and wore it with a turtleneck sweater coming out underneath the battle dress, which was sort of a waist thing. My father once said to me, he was a bit sour about the way I was turning out. He once said to me, I don't quite know what the association was. He said, I hope I'm not turning into one of these French socialists, all beard and belly.
Let's hear now your fifth record.
My fifth record is, it's a little bit of a narcissistic entry, but it's also nostalgic, because I used to know and listen to one of the Mississippi blues singers called Big Bill Brunzi, who was a fabulous guitar player and singer. And we heard that he'd got throat cancer and had to have the whole of his voice box taken out. Terrible thing for a performer of any kind. And so I wrote a piece which was based loosely on a melody that I associated with Big Bill Blues.
Thank you.
my castaway, Humphrey Lyttelton, and his band, and Big Bill Blues. Enjoyable memories then on the island listening to that, Humphrey, and your bandmates?
If I was on the island for a very long time, it would remind me that I once used to play the trumpet.
In 1956, an extraordinary thing happened. You played with your longtime musical hero, Louis Armstrong. His description of you as Britain's top trumpeter, I mentioned it in your introduction then, how did that come about?
Well, he referred to me, I have to say at this point, that any trumpet player in any country that he ever met, he referred to as a top trumpet player. So I don't put that up as one of my sort of rosettes. But on this occasion, we were in London's Empress Hall. We were brought in a little bit late after the first concert because he came over with a variety show, including a one-legged tap dancer.
You're not making this up, are you?
I'm not making this up. He was a one-legged tap dancer called Peg Leg Bates, who was quite famous in America because tap danced with a wooden leg. And he once said to me on one occasion that we were sitting about, because I could go into his dressing room and sit down and have a chat while we were doing the show with him. And he said, I'm doing a recording of my musical autobiography and I'm going to tell the people that you play this number for me. And I thought, well, this is something he says to everybody.
He died in 1971. That was about 9 years after your father died. How did Louis Armstrong's death affect you?
I have to say that it affected me more than did my own father's death, in the emotional sense, because, of course, there was music attached to it as well, and I've talked about the emotion of music. It was one of the worst experiences of my life. I was absolutely knocked sideways by it. Louis Armstrong's death, because it was such a complete part of one's life, affected people, you know, all over the place, not just myself.
So your sixth record, then, it really has to be Louis Armstrong.
Yes, indeed. And it'll recollect one of those moments when we saw him off at, I think it was King's Cross Station, and we set up on one of those huge great baggage trucks. So we set up outside his carriage. He got into his seat. We played one tune. We played another tune. And another tune after that. And it went on. The train was 15 or 20 minutes late in pulling out of the station. And I remember I played this number, That's My Home, as part of that farewell. And he hopped across the carriage and he opened those little windows that you could open on one of those carriages, and he cut his head half out and he sang the words of his song. And that would be a fantastic memory to keep.
And people should listen out in listening to this for Louis Armstrong's tribute within it to you, Humphrey Lyttelton.
Yes, I dismissed the idea and then he came up with this.
At my farewell party after my last trip to England, Humphrey Lyttelton, who's the top trumpet man in England today, he played this tune for me. Where the sunset in the sky, flowers never die, yeah. And friends don't pass you by, 'cause that's my home. Oh, where the folks say how do you do, and they really mean it too. Where mama's love is true, 'cause that's my home. I'm always welcome back, no matter where I roam. Just a little old shack to me is home sweet home. Where the Swanee River flows, where the shady pine trees grow, then I know that's my home.
Louis Armstrong, and That's My Home. So, Humphrey, your music career is very well established by, we're at the early 70s now, 1972. You are asked to do a pilot program, a radio pilot program. You already have your radio program on Radio 2 going strong, your jazz program. Why did they ask you to do I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue's pilot anyway?
Well, I'd done quite a few pilots over the years, because anybody who ever spoke for any length of time on radio eventually asked to do a pilot, and you got paid a studio fee, and you went home and never heard anything about it forever.
The conspiracy with us, the audience, is almost irresistible as a listener. You know, you've got the games with, as we say, no apparent rules. You've got the wonderful character of Samantha, who I always imagine is very buxom for some reason. And she's your sex-obsessed assistant. There's the non-existent high-tech laser display board that gives some of the clues to the contestants. That's the appeal as a listener. What's the appeal as a performer?
It's just such fun to do, because we all get on well together. Because I got my persona on the programme from how I felt when they rung me up and said, it's going ahead, back in 1972, and it's going on the air. And I drove in for the first recording then, thinking, what the hell am I doing? You know, I've got a perfectly good career. I'm not strapped for money particularly, and I just don't know what I'm doing here. And I've kept that thought to the forefront of my mind all the way through.
What's your seventh record?
My seventh record arises from something that I discovered. People have said to me, and I don't, I've never recognized it myself, that there's something about my timing. But in point of fact, somebody sent me an LP of one of the old Kenneth Horne shows, Round the Horn. And I always used to listen to that when it was a regular broadcast. And then I'd forgotten about it. I suddenly realized that I recognized in Kenneth Horne's approach to the thing something of what I do. And so I've realized that he was a huge influence on me. It may be due to the fact that he was, I'm alleged to be on the posh side, and he was also posh. And so he was doing much the same thing that I was doing, you know, slumming.
And now, Kenneth Horne, Master Spy.
My lean brown body scythed into the limpid blue water. I turned over on my back and floated lazily, and then adjusting my snorkel, I plunged below the surface. Suddenly, I saw it coming towards me, a killer shark. I slipped off the safety catch of my harpoon and pulled the trigger. The deadly trident cleaved through the water and buried its fangs in the hide of the monster. I was safe. I could breathe easily again. I surfaced, pulled out the plug, and got out of the bath. As the water gurgled down the plug hole, it left a ring. I answered it immediately. Hello. Hello, this is your friendly neighborhood spy here.
Oh, Mr. Horne, thank heavens you're there. Sob, sob, gasp, gasp. I'm in terrible, terrible trouble. Gulp, gulp, sob, gasp. I'm in the apartment opposite.
Would you come across?
A drop of a hat. But right now, Mr. Horne, I'm desperate. I came home 5 minutes ago to find my father, the well-known atomic scientist, missing, the butler and maid dead, and the chauffeur has disappeared.
Why are you phoning me?
Well, you know how bored you can get on your own. I thought a bit of company would be nice.
I'll be over immediately.
I thought you'd never get here. I'm Dr. Siegmund Eyre's daughter, Frieda, free to my friends.
Oh. Oh, I see. Free air.
Yes, but you have to buy 4 gallons.
Kenneth Horne with Betty Marsden from Round the Horn. So, Humphrey Littleton, you've had these two wonderful careers in jazz and radio that we've been talking about. But in the middle of this, of course, you were a father, grandfather, and indeed a great-grandfather. Your wife, presumably, was instrumental in keeping the whole show on the road at home.
Indeed, yes. There is an innate selfishness about, I might say, the performing art. In the sense that it does absorb you and it takes you away from home. But if you're lucky, and I was, Your wife manages to build her own career, apart from bringing up the children. She was a jazz fan, but she didn't like everything that I did, so that she would come occasionally to a concert and that kind of thing, but she didn't live that terrible life of a band wife, trailing along behind her husband.
And your wife died earlier this year. How do you think you'd handle what would be the inevitable loneliness on a desert island? Do you think you'd be able to cope with that?
I've been used to loneliness ever since I got on my bike and pedaled away from my sister's terrible friends in childhood. And I've spent a lot of time on my own. And the circumstances of when my wife died, I looked after her for a long, long time, which is a lonely experience in itself. So, and also I've got two families. How lovely to have two families. My own blood family and the band, which is like a family.
Tell us about your eighth record.
Next record will bring a little gaiety into my life. There's been some quite sad things in my music. I've always had a wish that I'd learned to play the piano and had been able to play it like Fats Waller. And also the fact that song pluggers used to go around in the 30s giving people sentimental songs to sing. And why they ever went in a studio where Fats Waller was, I don't know, because he used to slaughter them. And as he does indeed with a thing called It's a Sin to Tell a Lie.
Yes, but if you break my heart, I'll break your jaw and then I'll die. So be sure it's true when you say I love you. It's a sin to tell a lie. Now get on out there and tell your lie. What is it?
That was Fats Waller and It's a Sin to Tell a Lie. So you've got Shakespeare and the Bible on this island, Humphrey Littleton. There is one other book allowed. What would that book be?
Being interested, as I am, in cartooning and in humorous writing, I would take the collected works of James Thurber, the American cartoonist and humorist, who I find extremely funny. I haven't read all his stuff, but as a writer, I think he's even funnier than he was as a cartoonist.
What luxury item would you have?
Well, I think I'd have to take a keyboard, and then I could really get down to learning how to play like Fats Waller. But the keyboard that I think I should have, because I won't have, can't plug anything into the...
No, we don't give you electricity.
I know, and batteries, I mean, I can't be too useful. So I'm going to have a harmonium. You sit at it, pedaling, and playing lovely music.
And if the waves should crash onto the shore and attempt to wash away your collection of eight records, which one would you run through the sand to save?
Got to be the Louis Armstrong. It's got to be the Louis Armstrong, because I think, you know, you've got your emotions have got to be stirred regularly. Otherwise, you just become a boring old castaway.
Humphrey Littleton, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you, Kirsty. I've enjoyed it.
Well, Kirsty Young's castaway next Sunday is the pioneering surgeon Lord Aradaze. Desert Island Discs was created by Roy Plumley and the producer is Leanne Buckle. Hump Sunday continues after the news when Stephen Fry presents Chairman Humph, a tribute, which includes recollections from some of the regular panellists on I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue. And later there's a chance to hear Humphrey Lyttelton himself presenting a portrait of one of his musical heroes, Louis Prima, the King of the Swingers, is this afternoon at 1:30.